This is a special edition of the More Score podcast because we are celebrating the fabulous World Soundtrack Awards in Ghent, Belgium. That occurs every year for the last 20 plus years. And Daniel Hart and David Lowery, the composer and director respectively of wonderful films, which we'll talk about, are going to be celebrated at this festival in October. And I believe Daniel was just nominated for two awards, the Best Film Composer, a fabulous acknowledgement, and Best Song for another musical moment in The Brilliant Green Knight, directed by David. I guess, Daniel, you're also on the jury.
And, it doesn't sound fair, does it?
I think we're good. David, you and I should talk because we've just covered Daniel completely.
What did you have for breakfast this morning?
That's right. I always have, which is a bowl of blueberries. Kind of kicks my day off, and a lot of coffee, as you'll probably hear. You know, I first became aware of both of you with Ain't Them Body Saints and thought, okay, this is a super cool movie and a deep movie with two of my favorite actors. And I guess I've had the luxury of seeing something you're so close to you may not see, which is the evolution from that music and that movie to Green Knight. It's actually a fairly short period of time that your work has continued to be among the most creative. I mean, it's just, listen, my life is sort of, the genetic makeup of my life is making things. And so I see both of you making things and making new things and taking insane chances, which is the only way to be. So I thought I'd just ask some questions of you that you've either been asked 1,000 times before or never. David, are you musical?
I'm a frustrated musician in that I was never, I've got quite a few brothers and my dad were all incredible musicians, and I took piano lessons and can kind of plunk out a tune on the piano and play some major chords and fool people into thinking I know how to play for about 35 seconds. But that's about the extent of my abilities. But I like to think musically, even though I can't quite communicate the way I wish I could.
Oh, well, that's, you actually kind of anticipated where I was going, because when longtime collaborators work on many projects together, your musicality is not as critical for Daniel, because you, Daniel, I assume, intuit sort of where David maybe wants to go or doesn't want to go. But you know, some directors are not musical and say really insane things to their composers. You know, I want it more yellow, and could you give me more hair on that cue? And I've been through all that stuff. And I just wondered, David, if you have the, and it sounds like you do, at least you said you can think musically, which is really key, because then it gets to that moment. In one interview, one of you said that during Green Knight, there was a cue that, Daniel, you'd written that was that the movie rejected. You know, it just didn't work. And I think that's where the song came from. But did both of you know it at once? Or did one of you say, it's just, this ain't happening? Who made the initial call? And whose feelings were hurt?
David made that call.
I mean, the sheer...
My feelings were
hurt. And he made the call by saying, dude, love you. This ain't going in the movie. Or is it very gentle? Like, I mean, I've been through, you know, hundreds of these situations, and probably could write a book about the way that a director tells a composer from the abrupt, from the "you're fired, this is so wrong" to the bullshit Hollywood, "I love this, man. This is some of your best work. By the way, it doesn't work in my movie, but you're really at a new level." How did he tell you this cue wasn't working? And how did you come to a song as the replacement?
David's feedback is always couched in positivity, but it doesn't feel insincere to me, because I know him to be a positive person on the whole. And so his abilities as a scriptwriter are evident even in his feedback emails to me, right? They're incredibly well crafted, and he's really incomparably able to explain what he's thinking and feeling. And if I remember correctly, this section of the film that you're talking about, Robert, that this quote came from, was for the moment when Godwin meets the giants in the middle of the wilderness. And I had written a big orchestral cue for that moment. And I wrote that cue because I looked at the scene and I thought, well, it's the biggest moment in the film. It's literally the biggest moment in the film. It needs big music. It needs a big moment. And I did that, and I watched it back. And when I watched it back before sending it to David, I thought, this isn't, it's not doing what I thought it would. You know, I have the blueprint in my mind, and often the blueprint in my mind gets at least somewhat close to what it will eventually become when it gets to the point where it's the best version of what it could be. And this was not quite it, but I sent it on anyway, because I know that in situations like this where something isn't where I want it to be, but I'm not sure what to do next, David will know, or he'll at least say something that gives me the right way to go. And he said the thing that I was thinking.
Can I ask, when he said he isn't musical, when you said he'll know, is it take the piano out, or is it it needs to be darker in this moment? Is it an emotional? David, you can either listen or, you know, pretend not to listen. I just want to know the process. How does he let you know?
There's a mixture.
Specific or emotional meta?
Yeah, there's a mixture of both, right? He's able to talk about the feelings that we're looking for and the type of storytelling that we want to do in a more abstract sense, and also specifically from a storytelling sense, or from the sense of a director talking about the camera. But then he can also, he's taken time. I feel like he's really painstakingly taken time to learn enough musical vocabulary, especially now that we've started working with orchestras. He's taken time to learn enough about the orchestra to be able to talk to me in orchestral terms, and to know like the sound of a fake French horn, and to know the sound of a fake low wind. He may not know if it's a bassoon or a bass clarinet, but he knows that it's a woodwind, right? And so we can talk in these terms too, and he often will. And both of those things are helpful to me, right? Like, I want to know about the instrumentation, and I want to know about why something might not be working musically. But it's also important to both of us, I think, to know why something might not be working from a storytelling perspective. And in this particular case, I think that what wasn't working about a big orchestral cue for these giants was that it didn't, the movie rejected it in the sense of the movie's identity as a story, right? Like that music wasn't going to give us the true essence of what was happening to Garwin in that moment. And so he said, you know, the film, total, like, we have these expectations for what this should be. This is what he said to me in this email. We have these expectations for what this should be, and you have these expectations, and I have these expectations, and I thought something like this would work. When you look at it on paper, this is the right thing for this moment, but the film rejects it. And I thought to myself, yeah, exactly, that's it. The film rejects it. That also makes it feel a little less, like my feelings are hurt less, because it's not David rejecting it. It's just the film itself that's telling us.
It isn't
no.
me. It's you. No, it's actually not me or you. It's the film. I always refer to that moment as everybody in the room's shoulders go down when it works. You know, that it's tense during a playback. And if something works, their shoulders go down. Okay, what's next? So there must have been some consternation. Are you both physically in the same place when that happens? Or are you doing this by a mojo box digitally sending stuff between you and then there's a phone call? I'm not sure this is happening. Or are you watching something together in one of your home cities?
It's almost never in the same place. And in fact, yeah. I don't think we've been in the same room listening to things ever. Is that true?
We did it at least once on Ain't Them Bodies Saints, where I came over to your house and we watched together and talked about it. But that's the only time I can remember.
I suppose, go ahead.
I suppose with Pete's Dragon, that was the exception because you were working in the same building as us. And it was that mad rush from like March to June of just like, we're all living in that one suite in the Frank G. Wells building.
Oh, nice. In Blurbank.
In Blurbank.
Where are you? I'm going to guess. Daniel, I think you're in LA. And David, I think you're in Vancouver, or my many videos late on that.
I've been in Vancouver recently. I'm currently in LA as well.
Ah.
And still I live in LA. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm on the west side. Daniel's on the east side. It's like we're in different states.
Absolutely. The 405, I think, is sort of tantamount to being like the Atlantic Ocean or something. I had a rule when I was full-time head of music that I learned actually from a horrible event with my favorite Patrick Doyle, that being on different continents, the director and the composer became, that ain't going to happen again, because there was so much misunderstanding in files going back and forth that it became very clear. Patrick, you got to go to Heathrow right now and come to LA tomorrow, because he's not getting it. He's just not getting it. You need to walk him through the demos. Clearly, you guys have a shorthand where you don't have to sit in the same room. So that's kind of wonderful.
I find that I can communicate and organize my thoughts more efficiently if I'm writing them out. I'm a more erudite writer than I am a speaker. And so most of our communication is in emails and lately text messages, which has become almost alarming, the amount that we've collaborated via text messages on the most recent scores. But there is always value at least once on every movie, I think, where we do get together, and whether we're listening to cues or just talking through the movie. I hesitate to call it a spotting session, because sometimes the music's already there or sometimes it's not, but we're just watching it together. And that is a good experience to have, you know, even if music doesn't come into play at all, just sitting in a room with someone and watching the movie with them in whole or in part is very valuable. So that always happens at least once, but beyond that, it's been remarkably smooth to just, you know, have that sort of transcontinental, sometimes psychic link that allows us to collaborate without ever sharing physical space.
In this case, it's trans Los Angeles County. Speaking of the spotting session, with such a long history, do you spot the films together, or do you just send a movie to Daniel and he comes back with, I think we should put music here?
I think it's more of that. Like I send, with in most cases, I think, I don't know, Daniel, how do I send movies to you? Do I send you the entire thing, or do I send you a reel at a time?
We've been going mostly, like, I feel like we have reached the the version of it that we want it to be, which is you sending me as much of the movie as possible, and usually that's been the whole thing all at once, and with no temp music.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so rare.
That's been key to my process, not just in terms of music, but for the filmmaking itself, is I always want the filmmaking to function on its own before music is introduced to it. I never want, sometimes music can be an incredible band-aid, and I certainly have taken advantage of that, medical emergency supplies it can provide, but I do want the movie to function soundly as possible before music gets introduced to it. And so I always cut without temp score first. And if the, with our studio, the movies we made with Disney, there's a process there that requires temp score to be added in, but that still happens after I've cut the scenes to make them function as well as they possibly can with no music, to feel as musical as they can without music. And I think that's one of the reasons why we then don't have to have a traditional spotting session, is because the film itself is sort of like explaining where it needs the music. Again, we're putting the onus on the movie rather than on ourselves. And I always do have ideas. Sometimes it's even in the script, that I'll say the music starts here and stops there. But the but I'm never tied to that. I never feel married to that. And there are sequences in Green Knight that I always imagined without music, and I kept trying to make them work without music. But Daniel's perception of the movie always he always saw music in that place, and rightly so. And the movie rejected my attempts to remove score from those sequences.
Like the exact opposite of what happened. David, I'll tell you a quote of yours, which is either a quote of yours or Thich Nhat Hanh walked into the room to speak about living, because it's so deep, and it's interesting how it applies to both filmmaking and also, in this case, what you just described, which is you try to make the movie work. I don't know, Carol, if we've lost Daniel or not, but this is, I transcribed this quote of yours because it meant so much to me as a human being, not just as a creative person. You're back, Daniel. You're with us.
I'm back. Sorry, I missed something.
Good. I was just going to read a quote that I literally went back and forth scribbling down. Well, there were a couple of them. One of them, filmmaking wise, was you said in this scene with King Arthur's speech, and Sarita is cut against it. You said, and this is in Green Knight, kind of an amazing sequence, which I've watched a lot. You said, I try to get the rhythm perfect, bring Sarita into that circular rhythm that Sean was in. It took 15 months of editing. Fabulous, beautiful, brilliant. And then there's this score over it that's kind of rhythmic. And I thought, okay, how does this compute? Because this, I think about the rhythm of the score as it relates to the edit, and yet after you've done all that work and assembled something rhythmically, and then Daniel comes in and puts a rhythmic score over it, I'm just curious, in your process, does that upset the apple cart that you always had? Is it just that works, or you wrote Daniel to the edit and found the rhythm in your own work? Because I was so interested in your talking about the rhythm of the edit, David. So just in your
that sequence was something of a Russian doll, in terms of like it was always nesting within itself further and further. And when the first version of that sequence was cut without any of the material with Sarita in the other location and the spell. And so we make that version work as well as it can. Daniel, my memory is grayer now than it should be, but I think that you probably didn't start scoring that sequence until we had the footage of Sarita in there. And that could be wrong, or at least I don't recall. I know that.
I had started pre-Sarita.
You mentioned. Yeah, because that was we shot that material a few months after. That was one of our pickups.
I think you said that you needed it as a pickup.
Yeah,
we needed her in the movie more. She needed to be more present in that sequence. And so we reverse engineered all of that photography to match into, to cut into Sean's speech. And so that was one element that was nested in there. And then from there, the score imposed a certain rhythm on the way in which the cut worked. And from that, I then was like, okay, well, if the score, like if this downbeat lands here, I can make this cut between Sean and Cerrito work around that. It just kept functioning like that. And it certainly involved not only 15 months of me just refining the edit. And by, you know, 15 months of editing, it was like just iterations. It was not like it went into vastly different territory, but it was like sometimes a matter of frames, you know, just like I'd come back to it a few weeks after a few weeks away and be like, oh, I can make these little conjunctions function better. We didn't have that much footage of the king in Camelot. It was like two angles that we had shot, and it was, and I wanted it to feel as if every section had its own form to it. And so just trying to fake that and pretend that we had that was, there's a lot of, you know, clever deceit in there to make the two angles we had feel like six. And then as I'm doing that, that imposes certain changes upon the pace, which changes the rhythm, which then means I have to write Daniel and ask for a slight adjustment to the score. And I always felt that the score and the images can push each other along. Like each one is nudging the next so that you reach this culminating point when the doors to the Great Hall swing open. And every time I'd make an editorial adjustment, it would usually involve at least one little tweak to the score. But then there was a point where we thought we were done with it, and I took a month or so away from looking at it, and then went back and realized there was like another 15 to 20% that I could get out of that sequence. And I got it. But that required, again, revisiting the score and getting, you know, another 20% new, like a, I don't know how much that cue changed, Daniel, but I know that there was a lot in there. There was like always specific sections. Like it was like when Sean walks from the window to the middle of the room, I'd be like, this needs to like build here. When he gets there, it needs to reach a plateau for just a moment while he looks at Gawain, and then it needs to ramp back up again as he turns. And I was always like trying to, I think we sped the footage up even a little bit so that when he turns back to finish his speech, it gets faster. And that there was lots of like, just like little tricks in there, but the music always needed to, I definitely sent far too many versions to Daniel, and he's probably written far too many versions of that score, but it was never like, you know, there were never night and day differences. It was always very iterative, I think.
For me too.
I kind of love that. I kind of love the relationship evolving a particular sequence. And by the way, does the audience ever appreciate the subtlety of what you did? I mean, I've seen that movie maybe three times. I have no idea that you tweaked and retweaked and untweaked. And I guess I was just wondering, and it's a new evolution in the filmmaking process that the composer, you know, used to just be a music editor with a razor blade. If you wanted those changes, somebody would just kind of chop around what they have and try and make the cue work. And now to even have the beautiful availability of the tools for Daniel to go back and say, I'll just put a measure in here and all that. Daniel, where do you record? When you say orchestral recording, are you doing it on our fabulous stages in L.A.? Are you going to London? Are you doing it in a box? Where does David hear your orchestra?
Greed Night was done half at Air and half at my home studio.
Nice. In L.A.?
In L.A., yeah, here in Altadena. Yeah. This was partially to do with budget, like me wanting to spend the money in the right ways, and partially to do with me having more control over the sound of certain things. So we had, for example, we had a cello section at Air, but I recorded all the violins and violas for the Green Knight myself at home. Those are two of my main instruments. And I have a couple of each so that I can layer things and be more of a section. And that
you played them.
Yeah, I played them all. Mm-hmm. And
I know that you were a violinist while you were studying playwriting, which I think is the perfect combination for a film composer. So you actually understand story at a fundamental level and understand narrative arcs and character because you wrote plays or studied them. And then, so then you can speak the language. It's like, I asked David, you know, are you musical? It's like, Daniel, are you narrative? Well, I know that you are because you studied it. And so that's what a gift. Because I used to think that film scoring was a combination. I'd tell students and I'd talk to composers, of course, and hire them. And I thought it was two things. I thought it was talent, which was like 6%, and some kind of diplomatic genius that was 94%. Because you were always trying to explain to people how it worked. And the great and wonderful Hans Zimmer once said, oh, no. They were really wrong ratios, and you left out storytelling. I mean, that's really what it is. You're telling story. And it's diplomacy is important. Musicality is important. But storytelling for me is, what story are we telling? So I kind of love that you did playwriting, and I also really love Air Studios. But you don't go, David? You don't fly to London while he's there and do that and chill and drink Guinness and kind of hang out?
I definitely did on Pete's Dragon. That was there for our first time.
Oh, nice. Air.
And it was just it was like Christmas came early. I got to go hang out at this incredible studio, and I don't have anything to do at that point. I just sit and watch the music. And so it's like getting to hear an amazing symphony playing just for me is what it felt like. I was like, oh, this is what a gift this is to the movie that we're getting to hear this. It was really an emotional experience being there.
I bet.
With Green Knight, my memory of that time period is getting, as I said, a little muddy. I was either already on to Peter Pan and Wendy, or there were some COVID situation where I know Daniel, I think you did that remotely. When you were there?
No, I was there. This was January of 2020.
You were there?
I was at Air. Yeah, it's one of the last things I did.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And I think you were
one of the lulls. There were these.
You were in the Faroe Islands, David. You were filming for Peter Pan.
That's right. Yes, I was. We were already there. Yep.
Yep.
Is that a location that you use, the Faroe Islands?
It is. Yeah, that was our Neverland.
Oh, that's great. So you didn't go up to Michael Jackson's ranch and use some of those venues? Probably not.
We considered it and decided it was a poor choice.
Where did you record on Green Knight the Nickelheimer, Nickelbinky, the Swedish instrument that you found? Was that recorded
the
in
nickel
your home
harpa.
Studio?
Yeah, that was me at home.
Nickel harpa.
I played it all. Yeah. I played it all at home.
I think it saved the picture, frankly. I think that use of that instrument was critical. I thought it was great. David, here's the quote that kind of blew my mind, because maybe I'm not privileged enough to be with directors who are this deep about what their actual job is. You said, "More important than the legacy of your work is the way I comport myself when I make them. The integrity with which I live my life and my attempts to be a good person and do good in this world." This is where I thought, literally, the Dalai Lama is directing these movies. Simply because you said the most important thing that any of us could say about our work. It's true and rare.
I think back on the movie that we're finishing right now, and the movie is what it is, and it's going to be great, and it'll be out in the world, people will see it, but I'm not going to really, you know, right now no one knows it exists because it's not out. There's no trailer out. A year from now, it will be out in the world and people will have forgotten about it. And they'll have consumed it as a piece of entertainment and they may or may not have a Blu-ray on their shelves. Who knows? But the people who made it, you know, myself, Daniel, all of the amazing artisans and collaborators who came together to spend the better part of a year or more than a year making this film with us, they're going to have a memory. And they're going to have a memory of that time that they spent, that chunk of their lives that they spent. And it's really important to me that that those memories are good. And sometimes, you know, making movies can be really tough. There's a lot of drama that can go on in them. But if I can provide a silver lining to all of that difficulty and hardship and do whatever I can to make sure that those the bits and pieces that we all carry with us from those experiences are positive, then that's the most I can do. And also the least I can do. That's the least I can do, because I want those things to, I want those memories for the people who come to my side and help me make these films. I want them to be good. And every movie I make, it becomes more and more evident to me that that's what really matters.
Daniel, you are lucky.
Because yes, I am.
I've worked with, you know, if I've done 306 pictures at the studio, I would say zero directors have that level of insight into the relative importance of themselves and their work. David, it's rare. It's rare. And I think I respond to that because, you know, as the head of music, You're at an assembly line. You know, when I was working on a film as a composer, it was all consuming. It was all about me and it was all about my work. What would people think? And what would people approve of me or not? Then, you know, bizarrely, I end up the head of music and it's just a conveyor belt. And everybody thinks their movie is the most special movie that's ever been made. And I think we're going to win awards, man. I mean, I'm really, you know, if there was a move, whether it was Marmaduke or, you know, Big Mama's House 11, they all had a moment where they thought, this is my best work, man. I really think we're going to go all the way to the Oscars with this. And what could you say? You couldn't say anything, but God bless, man. I hope so too. But you get the kind of insight that you are articulating as to, I used to say, did you end up friends at the end of a movie? Because so few did. A lot of people would never speak after that premiere. I think the testament to what you're saying is the repeated use of a lot of the same talent. They respond to you and come back, particularly actors that are in your movies. You see them again and again. Daniel, you know, there's a lot of composers that sort of mm-hmm. say, thanks, man. You know, I have to rearrange my sock drawer for the next 2 years, so I can't do your picture because the emotional terror. And I think you just gave us a clue that Peter Pan is next year. Is it 23?
Yeah, it's sometime at the beginning of 2023. And fabulous. We're not done yet, but we're already looking, like, to me, that movie is receding into the distance and our eyes are turning towards whatever's next. And that being said, I still have to go finish some edits, which hopefully will not have any sort of repercussions on the score Daniel's already written.
It may, Daniel. Heads up. Heads up, dude. Keep your pencil sharpened. And it's funny when David says he's very erudite writing notes. Are they handwritten? Because a little birdie told me that he loves handwritten. Well, not a little birdie. My own eyes watching those movies, mm-hmm. the handwriting and all of them. The Dear Ruth and Dear Bob and the Middle English stuff is so beautifully shot and...
We just finished a new project that has more handwriting in it than any movie I've made yet. That Daniel, you'll get a cut of that later today. But the sad truth is that I put it all in my movies and then don't do it myself. You know, the dear Ruth in Ain't the Mighty Saints is me writing it. And
that's
I
great.
I realized I have atrocious handwriting. And so I don't do my own insert work anymore, but it is something I love and don't do enough of in my own life.
I can only pray that whatever you're referring to is the loss of the handwritten note. That is the great tragedy of our era. How great that we have text and email. Isn't that fun? But the value of the handwritten note, historically.
I hang on to them when I get them because I like having those mementos. And I used to have, you know, a big box full of letters that grew. Like my grandmother would write me letters, my aunts and uncles would write me letters, and that those days have ceased to be, but I still love when I can jot something down and leave it for someone or mail it to them as opposed to sending a text. But I will also readily admit that most of my communication is done. I can text with the best of them.
Well, I am in both camps, but I actually frame letters that are important, and I have a whole series
that's
just outside
great.
This room. Well, I had a correspondence for many years with somebody who was extremely important to me. I don't know if either of you are jazz fans, but I had a correspondence for many years with the Baroness Panonica de Königswarter, who was
the
Thelonious Monk's patron.
Oh, and wow.
Also, Charlie Parker died in her penthouse. And
wow.
I framed every letter she sent me and put it up. Because her letters, it started, I wrote Monk when I was in college. And I wrote him Christmas cards. And I had an address in Weehawken, New Jersey, and birthday cards. After he died, I got in the mail a letter from the Baroness saying, "You'll be pleased to know that when I was cleaning out Thelonious's room behind his headboard, I found all your cards and letters." And I had this moment of, Monk saved my cards, and I wrote her back, and we started a correspondence. Now, her letters are not just handwritten, they're multicolored. She would use different colored inks. And so wow. Your name would be in a color, the first paragraph would be in a color, her signature would be in a different color. And they are glorious works. They're like Barbara Kruger modern art text. And I long ago framed every single one and put it on a wall. And they're just these kind of beautiful,
colorful.
It's just wonderful. So I appreciate the handwriting and the loss of it. Gentlemen, you're very generous with your time. Daniel, needless to say, this is an unorthodox podcast because usually I'm asking composers about their different this cue and the, you know, why'd you use a bass line here? And we've actually talked more about filmmaking, but I must say I'm a huge fan. I hope you get props for Ain't Them Body Saints score, which I just dig completely. I just think that is the first time I'd heard of you. I went to look up who you were. Wait, who is this guy? This is something really... You know what it has in it? Even in the music, it has stillness. It doesn't really say, I'm going to step up to the front row and tell you what's happening. It says, I'm going to kind of be quiet here, even though it's a cue playing, and let the emotions come through. Let Rooney Mara be fucking great. I love her in that movie to death. I love her with Ben Foster. It's like kiss, come on, are you guys gonna kiss now? You know, there's so much there where you're just on the edge of your seat.
It's so much for me to work with.
It's so great.
It gives me so much information.
You know? That's so nice. That's so beautiful. I appreciate that. You can't write a great score if it isn't a great film.
Yeah.
You know, Jerry Goldsmith used to say, we worked on a picture called The Edge.
Mm-hmm.
Alec Baldwin and Anthony Hopkins about a bear.
And, you know, bear.
Right. exactly Bart the Bear who misbehaved terribly. They couldn't control him. And Alec Baldwin grew a beard right before shooting, and the head of the studio went crazy. I don't like the beard. I mean, those are the kind of fights that I would wait to have the music conversation until they settled, shave or no shave. But I said to Jerry at one point, you know, here I am with one of the great heroes. It was bad form to say, this movie really sucks, don't you think? I mean, they didn't get it together at all. You'd say, it's an interesting movie, don't you think, Maestro? Mm-hmm. What do you think about it? Which is the polite version. He'd say, I score the movie I want it to be. And I just love that.
Yeah.
You know, if this movie, if everything worked, this is the music I'm writing for it. And even if it didn't, I'm still writing that version. And that omits what you're saying, which is you get these great movies to work on, which is just so cool.
I'm so spoiled.
Cool. You guys are so cool and so smart and so talented. And I can't wait to see whatever you said, David, you alluded to. Of course, if I said what's next, you'd say, you know, I'm not free to talk about it. unless you're free to talk about it, but
People will find out soon enough. Good. It's something small. We'll
find
it's
out soon enough. But I just dig your work. I can't wait for what's next. Just because I like to revel in it. It's rare that you get this combination that works for this long. And I'm just glad you got to spend some time on a Sunday. It's anything you want to say to the World Soundtrack fans? Should they? Because I think we're going to put this up a month before you guys go to Ghent. Any special surprises? Anything you're going to wear when you're on stage that they should be particularly paying attention to? A particular pair of shoes that you think is kind of says everything? Or anything coming up that... Daniel, have you prepared your speeches for your win?
I have no speeches.
Those awards?
I should prepare something.
Man, I hate it when that
I'm
happens.
Terribly unprepared for speeches.
I'm just excited. There's like, sorry to interrupt you, Daniel, but you'll want to know this because you've not been to Ghent. But there's a vegan place called De Frikettel, which my memory of it is that it is a restaurant that serves many types of food, accompanied by the largest portions of French fries I have ever seen in my life. And so it's really a French fry restaurant that has like vegan bratwurst on the side. Very excited to go back there. I've not thought about Ghent much beyond visiting De Frikettel. Hopefully it's still in business. And then also there's a tremendous castle outside of which is a little wagon that sells mustard. That I bought some incredible mustard at, and I hope that's still there as well.
I think of a better reason to go to Ghent than fries and mustard. I don't know, in combination. Yeah. You remind me that also outside that kettle, full disclosure, I'm sorry, outside that castle, really great cigar store. That's just a beautiful store. I dig Ghent. I'm always happy in Ghent. Most people go for like,
it.
Yeah, and there's a cool dinner. I hope you get there in time for the big dinner they have for the talent in a kind of church hallway, ancient thing. Things are ancient there, not like in L.A. Well, Daniel, you're going to win some awards, and I guess the only person you got to thank is, you know, David and...
That's right.
And your violin teacher, right?
Yeah.
You can get a lot of mileage out of that. Gentlemen, many thanks for all of that. We didn't get a chance to talk about the first day you shot The Green Knight and the horse was in heat, which is kind of like my favorite showbiz story of the week, and how you had to work. You couldn't take the day off, and you had to work around it. That is showbiz 101.
Mm-hmm.
But... cheers to both of you. Maybe the two of you will actually meet halfway between East and West LA. You might even fly together.
I think it might actually happen. That'll be we'll reunite in person. On
Alert the media.
Flight.
Have a great time at the WSA. Win some awards. Keep in touch. And thanks for your time on Score the Podcast.
Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you.
We are here, Carol and I, to do a very special episode of More Score. Carol, welcome to the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Composer Carol. And this is special for us because we're going to share the nominees for the upcoming World Soundtrack Awards, which are, for all of you who have never been to Ghent, Belgium, absolutely worth the trip. The World Soundtrack Awards are fabulous, unique, and it's just a beautiful event. You go to this medieval city in Belgium, and they celebrate film music. I think that combination is kind of as close as any film music fan will get to absolute nirvana, no pun. I love going there. We have the World Soundtrack Awards coming up in October. Not long from now. And some of you may have already heard the episode we did recently with Daniel Hart and David Lowry, who are respectively the composer and director of Green Knight, which is also up for a music award. And they're also going to do a very special event at this year's World Soundtrack Awards where they talk about the relationship between the director and the composer in getting film music made. So I really recommend putting it on your calendars if you can, getting to Ghent in October for the WSA World Soundtrack Awards. I'm a huge fan, as you can imagine. And this year we're actually going to do this special episode. Carol and I are going to go through the nominees. So you really know what this festival is about and who's going to be there. I'm going to start off, Carol. Is that good for you, for me to do the first category?
Yeah. All right. Let's get to it.
We're going to get
first to it. First category is Film Composer of the Year.
Thank you.
We have Jermaine Franco, who's up for Encanto.
Beautiful.
Johnny Greenwood, The Power of the Dog, and Spencer.
Yep.
Daniel Hart, who did Green Knight, The Last Letter from Your Lover.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Alberto Iglesias for Parallel Mothers. And then Daniel Pemberton for The Rescue, being the Ricardos, the bad guys, Brian and Charles. And then last but not least, we have Hans Zimmer for Dune, No Time to Die, and The Survivor.
Great Pretty
category.
Powerful. Pretty
Very
powerful.
Powerful.
Mm-hmm. I mean, amazingly, to have Jermaine and Hans up against each other is, for many of us, a great smile, because that's really kind of the master and student kind of meeting each other on the battlefield. I sort of love that. Let's go through the TV composers of the year. You want to read them off? And
sure.
There's such unbelievable competition.
Another
here.
Great. Yeah, this is crazy. We have Nicholas Britell for Succession Season 3.
Yep.
We have Natalie Hold and John Williams for Obi-Wan Kenobi. We have Jung Jae-il for Squid Game. And then we have Hisham Nazi for Moon Knight. We have Theodore Shapiro for Severance. And then lastly, we have, I'm going to butcher this name, so I'll let Robert take this.
Cristobal Tapia De Vere, the amazing composer
Amazing.
Of White Lotus. They're all favorites of ours. Many of these, I think almost all of them, except Hisham Nazi, have been on our show, which means we're going to
need... No, Hisham has been on our show.
Oh, he has. You're
actually,
right.
Yeah.
He was on a show that Matt did. Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly right. So I think we've got them all. I don't even want to predict. It's too hard a category.
Yeah.
Though I may sing the White Lotus theme as we're going to the next category. Best Original Song, a really wonderful category, and also another kind of killer competition. Should I try and pronounce that first title?
Yes.
From Green Knight? It's Old English, forgive me, if I've butchered it, but it is Blom Sweet Little Flower, which probably is Bloom Sweet Little Flower. It's written by Daniel Hart, who is the composer of Green Knight, and he's going to speak about it, I'm sure, at the World Soundtrack Awards. Next, Carol, you want to fire away with the next ones?
Yes, we have Hold My Hand, written by Blood Pop and the great Lady Gaga, and this is from Top Gun Maverick.
Yep. Then we're going to go with Don't Look Up, which you, I know you like the movie Don't Look Up, and the song is called Just Look Up. It's written by Nick Bertel, who scored the film, of course, Ariana Grande, Kid Cudi, and Tora Stinson. A really great song by top songwriters. You want to tell us about the next one?
My favorite. This is No Time to Die, written by Billie Eilish and her brother, Phineas, amazing producer, from No Time to Die.
Right, and kind of hard for it not to be a favorite of all of ours. It's really an epic James Bond song. Strange Game is next. With a what a combination of talents, Daniel Pemberton and Mick Jagger. How about that? From the amazing Slow Horses series, which is so cool. Really kind of one of my favorite kinds of series, and I just loved it. And then finally, of course, we don't talk about Bruno.
No.
Yeah. Lin-Manuel Miranda from Encanto, big hit song. Here's an interesting category coming up. And Carol, you want to tell us about the Sabam Award for Best Original Composition by a Young Composer?
Amazing category, and I love that they do this for young composers. Yeah. We have John Consolakis. I'm sorry if I butchered that.
That's okay. And we have Giacomo
Rita.
Yep.
And then, last but not least, Robert Wallace.
I always like this category. All amazing. Because I start to see these names popping up, and it's great to first see them here. How about Best Original Score for a Belgian Production? I'm going to take a shot at saying these names. Please forgive me.
Go ahead, please
and
do.
Congratulations to all Belgian composers. We don't get a chance to see your work as often as maybe we should or would like, but I bet it's beautiful. The first one is the film Inexorable, by Vincent Cahay. The next one is the film Nowhere by Demus Maker. I'm going to hope that that's right. And finally, Space Boy by the Penelopes. I don't know how many Penelopes there are, but they are all here for Space Boy. How about the Public Choice Award? I think there's something really interesting here. You want to read them off, Carol? And I'll tell you what I think is kind of amazing.
We have 14 Peaks, Nothing is Impossible by Nainita Desai. We have Charlotte by
Michelino Biscaglia.
Michelino Biscaglia. Okay. Next, we have Gunpowder Milkshake by Frank Elfman. And then we have The Ice Age Adventures of Buck Wild by Batu Sener. And then we have The King's Daughter by Joseph McCaff, John Coda, and Grant Kirkhope.
I'm going to tell you a quick story about The King's Daughter, which is kind of remarkable. I was hired, I think, in 2016 to be the executive music producer of a film called The Sun and the Moon, which was shooting in, actually, at Versailles, the great Louis XIV, incredible estate and castle just outside of Paris. It's not a castle. It's like the mansion of mansions with the beautiful grounds. And what an opportunity to go to Versailles for 3 weeks. I took along a young composer named Nick Bertel, who had just done some incredible work that I'd heard. And Nick and I went to Versailles for 3 weeks, where Nick was responsible for the on-camera music. And the on-camera music was, one of the characters had to play cello, and there were some string quartets, all this taking place in the 1600s at Versailles, and Nick and I basically just had an incredible time putting together the music. Then we hired the wonderful Heitor Pereira to score the film. All was good, and then, as can happen in Hollywood, the film disappeared. It didn't get released. It didn't get completed. We don't know what happened to it until this past year, when the film has reemerged, completely re-edited, completely rescored, and it's reemerged as a film called The King's Daughter. And here we see at the Public Choice Award the new composers, Joseph Metcalf, John Coda, and Grant Kirkhope, have clearly written a new score to this film. Forgive me, fellas, I haven't seen it. A little dicey for me to go back and look at a movie I worked on that was kind of shelved and then completely changed. But I think it'd be remarkable if you won. Not to say that I don't have some other favorites, but God bless. Let's name the discoveries of the year and then wish all our nominees a good luck. You want to go through them, Carol?
Yeah, sure. We have Carl Fried for Pleasure. And then we have Eiko Ishibashi for Drive My Car.
Unbelievable movie.
We have Sunlux for Everything Everywhere All at Once. Amazing movie.
Yes.
And then I'll let you take the last two.
Maurizio Malagnini for Coppelia, which I wanted to see. And then finally, our friend Isabel Waller-Bridge for Munich, The Edge of War. I mean, they're all great. You said that you saw Sun Lux recently at an event.
Yeah. I was at a workshop, I attended a workshop that they hosted with Sundance Institute, and they were sharing about their process in scoring Everything Everywhere All at Once, and it was great.
I bet.
A great movie, one of my favorites of this year.
Kind of amazing, and I read an interview this weekend with the two directors who go as the Daniels.
The Daniels. They were there as well in the workshop.
Oh, that's so lucky. Mm-hmm. They were asked a question from the audience about why they gave those characters hot dogs as fingers, and which is this kind of incredible moment in the movie, and they said, well, it's something a five-year-old would do, and we basically like stuff that five-year-olds would do. I thought, okay, I don't know a lot of directors that would respond that way or actually film it, but God bless them. And may I just say, in closing, good luck to all our nominees. Please come visit us after you win at More Score, the podcast. And thank you, Carol, for helping me get through this incredible list of huge talent. I know how hard everyone works to put all of this together. And if you're lucky enough to get to Ghent, Belgium for the World Soundtrack Awards this year, I guarantee a fabulous time. Good luck to everybody. We'll see you soon. Cheers.
Cheers.